Finds Feiner. He's got Brewster shooting deep. Feiner pulls the trigger. Brewster chasing it down. Ambrose goes shoulder high to knock that disc to the turf and even has the presence of mind to get up and stop Brewster's second attempt.
That was special.
Welcome back. It's Swing Pass. I'm Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. We finally got big offseason signing news. The Seattle Cascades announced just a couple hours ago that they will be adding the 2023 Rookie of the Year and the league leader in blocks, Lucas Ambrose, to their roster for the 2024 season, giving an already much-hyped Cascades roster an additional spark plug on defense, the side of the disc that they have struggled with most over the past several seasons. So now the question becomes, is Seattle a playoff contender in an already contentious and packed West Division playoff race? We've got tons to talk about in this episode. Additionally, we'll be going over some of the most anticipated 2024 storylines and news items we're most excited for. But first and foremost, we've got to get to this big offseason signing announcement. We've kind of been waiting for it. Obviously, 2 weeks ago, there was the John Lithgow and Jeff Weiss signings with Chicago. But this Ambrose one, it's just got that extra level of spice to it. I mean, last season, he made more highlight plays on the defensive side of the disc than I would arguably say, and this is totally anecdotally off the top of the dome, but more than anybody else in the history of this league. I mean, when you talk about just jaw-dropping layout block ability, it's Lucas Ambrose, and it feels like a gap between the next closest defender. He's just got this playmaking ability that separates him from seemingly almost any other player in this league. What was your impression watching Ambrose sort of take over last year? I mean, he had 7 multi-block games. He had 24 total blocks. Just the second player to reach that mark since we restarted playing 2021. Again, as an offensive player, when you see Ambrose out there playing defense, what do you think?
Well, with the way he can cover ground, especially once he's left the ground, how much ground he covers in the air, it's one of those things where you can never get comfortable. Like, there's never a disc that you should ever feel like you clearly are going to get. You know that he's always kind of right behind you. You could argue that the three or four best blocks from last year were all him. Like, he was that, like, jaw-dropping with some of the ones. Was it the one, was it on Cody Spicer going deep? I can't remember exactly who it was. One of the big guys out in Colorado. I think that one is the one that I keep going back to, of like, he seems to be way too far out of reach to be able to get to it. And then he gets his whole hand on it. It's not even like he barely touches it. Not only that, he had the greatest in the playoff game where he saved it. And that was a huge, you know, kind of momentum play in that game. So he was just kind of making plays all over the field. And to come in first year and do that is amazingly impressive. They got to be hurting in LA. I've actually already seen some tweets out there from some former teammates of his now, and they're already feeling his absence. They loved having him there. Obviously, anytime you have a person like that that can generate blocks, those guys are rare. There are not a lot of block generators who can kind of do it on their own. I've been fortunate enough to play with a guy, Nick Hutton, who has done it very well for a long time. But there are not players like that that are just like floating around. Like, if you can get more than one or two of those guys on your team, you feel like you really have something going for you. So for Seattle to add Lucas Ambrose to a team that, you know, I was already feeling pretty good about with all of the re-signings that they had, this might be the thing that pushes them, you know, up to that third slot. I still don't want to say that they're quite going to contend with Colorado or Salt Lake yet, but this certainly closes the gap.
Yeah, I mean, Seattle goes from kind of frisky to outright feisty, if not contentious, in the West Division with the single addition. And rumor is that with rosters being announced at the beginning of next week, Cascades aren't done with some more big offseason signings. So it'll be really interesting to see where the Seattle roster ends up as we go into 2024. Because again, this Cascades team has not made the playoffs since 2016. It's been a long absence from the postseason and a lot of tumult year to year in their lineups, in their rotations. And as we talked about a couple weeks ago on this podcast, it felt like with those re-signings you mentioned, the Khalif El-Salam, last year's All-UFA nomination, Garrett Martin, who is one of the league leaders in scores, Zeppelin Ronick, Jack Brown, Mark Munoz, this young upcoming core that feels like it's just at the beginning part of their prime years. Like, this is an exciting team that I would have put near the top 10, maybe even top 5 in terms of just like watchability for you to talk about like UFA TV rankings. But now you add in Ambrose. I mean, we saw it last year with LA. There are all these other, obviously, much hyped additions to the 2023 LA Aviators. You start with Pavel Yanis, Sean McDougal. They bring in Daniel Brunker from Colorado. They add Jason Valley from Chicago as well, coming over with Pavel Yanis. There's many ballyhooed kind of veteran presences coming aboard for the Aviators last year. And yet it was Ambrose who wasn't really talked about at the beginning of the season. You know, this kid out of the University of Oregon, Noah Kuhlman's roommate, the Summit defender, who is also fantastic at generating blocks. Oddly enough, two of the best, I shouldn't say oddly, circumstantially, coincidentally enough, two of the best block getters in the league heading into 2024 were roommates in college. Ambrose came into LA, not much hype, not much talk about him in the preseason. But talking with some of the Aviator players after their first couple games, they just encouraged him to start baiting a little bit more on that defensive side of the disc and trusting in his instincts and his acceleration and explosiveness. And you look at the results. I mean, I think he had 2 blocks in his first 3 games, and then he had that 5-block game against Colorado where he had the block you were describing earlier on Thomas Brewster in the deep space. He got 4 others that game. He went on to, again, have 7 multi-block games as a rookie. Aviators went from being 23rd as a team in blocks per game in 2022 to 14th in 2023. And while that wasn't completely the singular presence of Ambrose, his almost 2 blocks a game added in there is certainly an impactful element to their improvements on defense. And now he joins a Cascades team that was 7th last year, very, very quietly in takeaways per game. They were one of just 8 teams to finish with over 10 blocks per game. Sort of just not exactly earning it in terms of matchup defense, but they're able to cause enough chaos and I think find opportunity on that side of the disc that Ambrose's presence will only elevate it further. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of opportunities they can actually take care of with that, because Seattle last year was not good in its defensive efficiency. And that's been one of the ways in which they've really struggled the past several seasons in this league. They've finished in the bottom 6 usually perennially. Last year they finished middle of the pack, so again a little bit better. So we'll see now with an additional couple of blocks per game and Ambrose's presence if they can elevate that even further.
Well, he's a good guy that's on the counterattack too. I mean, we saw sometimes him going on the O-line for LA last year, but hey, I saw a tweet from Eddie Finley, a teammate of his in LA. How about that McDougal-Ambrose matchup that we might be seeing during the season? That is going to be a fun one because McDougal was kind of the do-everything. As great as Ambrose was defensively, Sean McDougal was kind of getting it done all over the field, whether it was with the disc in his hands, striking deep, or even getting the disc back for the offense when he was forced to play defense. So I think that's a matchup I'm really excited to see. I don't think either one of them is going to be lacking for confidence, and I think that's going to be a fun one. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be great to see what he does for Seattle. I think he both improves their immediately. He's going to improve their block numbers and also improve their conversion percentage on the other side when they do get the disc. So this is, you know, maybe the biggest and for my money, probably the biggest offseason movement we've seen this year. You know, some of the other ones definitely are good and impactful and, you know, some re-signings from guys that maybe didn't play last year, like Jeff Weiss. But this one, this is like the home run, right? This is the big one. So this will definitely, if you weren't already considering keeping your eyes on Seattle this year, I think this is the thing that draws your eyes there and keeps them there.
And yet the thing is, like, Seattle has to overcome at least 4 other teams ahead of them in the West Division standings from last year to even get into the mix of the playoffs. And it stands to figure that after having a kind of down year last year, they miss the playoffs for the first team time in five seasons. San Diego will rebound a little bit in 2024. I think they're going to have more stability and a little bit more oomph after, some tragedies, injuries, and a lot of roster confusion last year sort of beset them. The West is just, again, sort of stacked. I even look at Portland's roster right now coming in on our league roster doc, and they look, I think, while not anywhere near a playoff team, I think they'll be a little bit better than the 1-11 squad we saw last year and the team that struggled to win just one game in their past, what is it, like 21 overall games going back to 2022. I mean, Portland has really been struggling. I think that they're going to be a little bit more competitive on the field. There's not going to be much margins for error, and Seattle still feels like one of those teams that, for all the highlights, the sort of eye-catchy end zone eyes appeal of this team, is there enough else there? Is there enough depth? Like, one of my questions with this Ambrose ad is this the kind of defender that they need? You know, again, you look at this team, they were already top 10 in takeaways last year. Ambrose is obviously going to add to that total. They might even push into the top five this year. But I think one of the critiques, for as good as he is at generating turnovers, for Ambrose is that he can also allow some big plays. There is a risk and a reward element to his style of defensive play where, yes, he gets the turnover, but just as likely he can give up the big play. I think back to there a couple matchups against Max Gibson on the Growlers, their standout rookie last year. He had some big production numbers against them. I think LA won the games, but Gibson was a demonstrable offensive force for the Growlers in those matchups. You talk about the playoff game against Jordan Kerr, you know, Ambrose got Kerr a couple of times in the regular season games, but in the playoffs, Jordan Kerr just kind of ground him down into dust. I mean, Ambrose didn't really have a chance to make any plays because Kerr just sort of made him run around in the mid game and didn't give him a chance to launch on some of those layout blocks. He didn't really stretch downfield. Ambrose is really good, I think, in kind of track meet open field environments, but if you get him into a little bit more of circuitous motion, you can at least maybe take advantage of some of his aggressiveness and just sort of find more space and opportunity as a thrower, a distributor. And obviously Kerr has been one of, if not the best, over the past two seasons in that Salt Lake League leading offense. So getting back to my point, I guess a question for you is, obviously, I think just this, the highlights, the excitement, the need fit for Seattle just needing a top-end defender without sacrificing somebody from their offensive unit over. Like, all of those are reasons enough for your point about Ambrose being the signing of the offseason, but is it enough? You know, I think that that's the biggest question. Is this going to make Seattle an actually playoff team? You hinted at sort of you liking them, but are you enough to anoint them a top-three team in the West this season?
I mean, we are still waiting on rosters to come in, so I don't want to say anything definitive at this point, but like with what I know about rosters across that division right now, if I had to pick a third team to make the playoffs, as we've discussed multiple times, we both feel pretty comfortable with Colorado and Salt Lake being 1 and 2 in whatever order that ends up in. I think right now I would favor Seattle. When you look at their season last year, they were clearly above Portland. I mean, they won all of their matchups with Portland and San Diego, who were clearly the two bottom teams in the division last year. They had some close games with some of the teams that were ahead of them. And this was before, you know, adding Ambrose. This is before having multiple seasons with like guys on the offense working together. So I think I would at this point favor Seattle, but it's not a huge gap. Like, it's not something where I would want to put any sort of money on this. Like, this is completely like, you know, if I had to grade these teams on their chances to make the playoffs, maybe they're a couple percentage points ahead of like LA or Oakland. I think the other thing though, you mentioned being able to take advantage of them out. I mean, Jordan Kerr honestly probably isn't the matchup for him. I think one thing that sometimes is lacking when it comes to defensive strategy in this league is you think that you need to put your best defender on the other team's like best player. And I don't think that's always the case. I think you should actually be more looking at like, what does your defender do best? And what player on the other team would that be most effective against? I would think like putting him on like a Jace Dunabile, like somebody who wants to stretch deep a lot more and doesn't want to be as much of a distributor as Jordan Kerr. That kind of seems more like Ambrose's wheelhouse. Like, yeah, you're pretty much okay with giving him the disc a lot in the middle of the field. Not because he's necessarily going to turn it over, but he's just not going to be the person who's going to consistently hurt you with the disc in his hands, right? So that might be something where that was like a matchup error from the coaching staff. Like, you need to maybe fix that, who you're putting on that person. But we also know the West is like the Huck heavy West. So a player like Ambrose, who is so good at baiting those deep shots and then chasing them down, he probably couldn't be in a better position, a better, you know, division to go and get blocks, because he's going to get plenty of opportunities out there with the Huck numbers being as high as they are out there compared to other divisions. Regardless, I think you live with the good and the bad, right? I remember listened to Justin Burnett on a podcast a few months ago, and he kind of was talking about this concept. You're talking about the risk reward thing, where, you know, in this league with the field being so big, and it just being hard to really generate all the time as a team ways to get the disc back, you have to know when to make that risky bid, that bid that might put you out of position if you don't get the disc, or when you want to try to bait a little bit to try to get the offense to throw something you really want them to throw. And I think if you're on offense in that division, and you know Lucas Ambrose on the other side of the field, I think that's one thing you kind of need to take note of, is like, who is his matchup? And maybe throwing deep to that matchup isn't really what we want. We've done this. We used to play the game, where's KPS? Like, in the Central Division, we would play against Madison, because we just knew when we were throwing the disc, he could kind of be anywhere. He might be poaching off here, might be poaching off there. And I remember pretty consistently, every time I caught the disc, I waited an extra half second before I threw anything, because the first thing I wanted to know before I threw it was, is KPS nearby? Because he might be, for all I know, he might be literally hiding behind his teammate just so he can pop out and grab this disc. So I think you kind of got to play that game with Ambrose too. Like, you don't really want to throw deep to that matchup unless there's just a clear amount of steps and you can put it out on a line in front. Because anything that hangs, that's going to have Ambrose's hands all over it.
Well, and if he's even kind of in that third of the field, I think one of the things that was most impressive to me from watching film of him in the back half of his first season was how much he adapted to peeling off and helping out in deep space. I remember in the second regular season game against Salt Lake in LA, he got a block on Jordan Kerr in deep space doing that. Kerr was guarded by somebody else, and Ambrose peeled off of his matchup and went and got a block in space. So yeah, if it's open field and he has any kind of ability to track it, it feels like Ambrose is going to be somewhere in the mix. And another part that really gets lost sort of in his overall numbers and production from last year, he led the league in defensive points played. You know, this is a workhorse. He didn't really seem to have any wear and tear despite launching himself shoulder high, you know, three dozen times throughout the season. So Seattle picks up one of the most impactful defenders that this league has ever seen. It will be added to their obviously offensive, heavy attack going into 2024. But again, they've got to clear four teams that finished above them in the standings in the West Division last season in order to have a shot making the postseason. I guess they don't have to clear all four of them. They just have to clear two.
Just two.
But LA and Oakland are going to be fierce once again in 2024. Really excited to talk more about those teams as we get full roster unveiling again next week. We can really start to dig into everything. But for now, we're going to take our bird's eye approach and get into some of the bigger 2024 narratives coming up. And first and foremost, we're going to start with the biggest headline, with the biggest team. And I think, you know, just sort of the sun under which we're all sitting right now, and that is the New York Empire and their reign, right? I mean, 30-game winning streak ties the current UFA record with the 2013-14 Toronto Rush for longest in league history. Back-to-back titles also tying the franchise record set by the Oakland Spiders back in 2014 and 2015 when they won back-to-back. New York has three total UFA titles. They're the only UFA team to have that many. They've had the last four MVPs in Ben Yacht twice, Ryan Osgar, and then last season with Jeff Babbitt. They had the best defensive performance, arguably, I don't even think it's really arguable, actually, anymore. Best defensive performance from a team in 2023. They sort of epitomized this new era of defense. And so the question just becomes, when will this end? Like, what is going to slow this New York team down? Is it going to be an opponent? Is it going to be simply them moving past the window of this opportunity and this excellence? You know, they are one of the older rosters in the league at this point. With all that stability and success comes a little bit of a mortgaging away, I think, of some of your opportunities at development and interjecting youth into that lineup. Thankfully, I think for the rest of the East Division opponents, right, you get to at least see this New York roster progressing a little bit in terms of age, at least, if not L's in the loss column. Mm-hmm. But this New York team is a juggernaut. We've talked about it so, so much. I think sometimes we even evade talking about this team because you could just go on and on and on ad nauseum about how impressive their accolades and performances have been, both on an individual and systemic level for the past 4 to 5 seasons. So what is it going to be, I think, that either sustains New York this season or takes them down? I'm willing to go either way on this, but I'll leave you kind of first hack at what do you think is going to be the thing that really carries New York forward and maybe makes them have a seemingly unimaginable third consecutive perfect season? Or is there something possibly in the works that could put a chink in their armor? Is there an opponent or a matchup that could sort of finally put some kind of dent in this team's progress?
Yeah, I was kind of racking my brain knowing we were going to talk about this. Like, what is the thing? Like, what kind of team beats New York? Because we haven't seen it for a long time. But what kind
of team
beats
The last team to do it was Atlanta in 2021 in week 8 of the regular season. Or excuse me, sorry. 2021 championship game.
Yeah.
My bad.
I was about to say Carolina. But you know what? Carolina and Atlanta, the last two teams to beat them, have in common, at least if you want to put something in common about them other than the fact that they're in the same division, is the style of offense they play is not overly reliant on like any one person. While they do have players that stand out and might have big games maybe more often than others, it's not like when you think of the Salt Lake Shred, you think of Jordan Kerr before anyone else. And 9 times out of 10, he's having the biggest game of anyone on that offensive unit. I think when you look at teams like Atlanta and Carolina, it's so much more about the system and moving the disc and looking for good opportunities. When we saw Carolina really falter in 2022 when they were playing against New York, I mean, other than it being the fact that New York was just kind of playing otherworldly that day, you really saw Carolina kind of go away from their system almost, and kind of like you had guys taking shots who normally didn't take deep shots. Like, you know, you kind of had the reverse of what you wanted in some of those opportunities where you had somebody throwing a deep shot to somebody who you wish was the one throwing the deep shot. It was really weird. But when they're at their best, both those teams, it kind of feels like everyone's touching the disc. It's moving from person to person. They don't really care if they score in 2 throws or if they score in 30 throws. And I think like that's the team that really, that type of team is the team that could potentially beat New York. That's why I think like Salt Lake struggled so much, other than the fact that obviously New York is very talented and their defensive line doesn't get enough credit for just how talented they are. I mean, they have as many good matchup defenders as, you know, some entire divisions, I feel like. But that team's so dependent, like they want to move fast. Like Salt Lake is clearly most comfortable moving fast and scoring quickly. And we saw in both the Minnesota game and the New York game how like kind of sometimes pedestrian their offense can look when they can't move quickly. So I think that's kind of what it takes. So when I think of like teams that I think have the best chance to knock New York off for an individual game, Atlanta, who they do play, definitely comes to mind. If they get a matchup with Carolina, depending on what that roster looks like, if we can kind of see the Carolina that we saw in 2021 and 2022, I think a team like that has a chance. And I know I've mentioned it before, and this is like for completely different reasons. I think Philadelphia just like does not fear New York. Like, they just have all the confidence and bravado in the world. And I think that is another element of it, just the belief that you can do it. And Philly does. And they play, you know, I think I actually read today, I was going back and looking at some old UFA stuff. And I kind of knew this, but I didn't like know it, that like Philadelphia has not only had close games in New York, but they've been, every game they play with DC is a 1 or 2 goal game. Like, so that team is clearly capable of playing with some of the best talent in the league, and they show it every year. So if I had to pick, like, the other team I'd throw in the mix is Colorado. Like, Colorado's not overly reliant on one person. Their offense is pretty dynamic. It seems like they have 4 or 5 guys that can kind of, you know, take the torch of, I'm going to be the guy on this point, and if I need to be. So teams like that, that really spread the disc around, they're fine being a little more patient when they need to, and they have big playmakers that aren't afraid to go up against those New York Empire defenders. Those are the teams I look at as kind of like the biggest threats to New York.
Yeah, I'm somebody who so much wants to tether stuff to analytics and some sense of what the numbers are telling us or what the film tells us, some sort of eye test. But when you bring up Carolina's 2021 championship game against New York, the Atlanta game against New York, and even how Philly has played them, the thing that I keep coming back to when I just relax my brain and think about what best approach can you have against this Empire team, it's having confidence. It's the thing that I have not seen opponents take in the last 2 championship weekend events against the Empire. They let them come in like they were the reigning champs, and they played those teams as such. And it's just, when you let New York, for all their talent, also have kind of that psychological edge, they just run teams over. I mean, that's what they did against Austin and Salt Lake right out the gate in 2023. In 2022, Carolina and Chicago held on a little bit longer at the beginning parts of those games. Chicago even kind of made it contentious up through the third quarter, but there was sort of an inevitability with the way that New York was playing and the way that they kept making the biggest plays and gaining momentum, that I think, to your points about Carolina, Atlanta, and Philly, is that they don't let those big New York plays deter them from coming back, being balanced, attacking from all positions again, and sort of pushing against New York and trying to get the Empire in a position where, for the love of God, once their luck has to run out. I mean, the thing that just becomes sort of insurmountable in my brain is that the amount of walk-offs and buzzer beaters and clutch moments that this New York team has had in the fourth quarter overtime, double overtime, over the past 3-4 seasons is ridiculous. It doesn't make sense within the context of our sport, and it doesn't make sense within like the context of general sports play. You're just, there's supposed to be a regression to the mean here at some point. There's supposed to be a time where, oh, the Jack Williams Hail Mary to Benyat fell to the ground. Like, it doesn't happen. They come down victorious every single freaking time. My brain strains to think of ways to overcome that kind of almost divine intervention that they seem to have at times. Like, it almost seems like it's scripted or something. It's stupid. It's stupid is what I'm trying to say.
Well, you talk about confidence, and, you know, going back to that 2022 game against Chicago in the championship, you know who didn't have confidence? The coaching staff. Let's talk about the fact that their D2 line didn't even get on the field in the first half because they were just trying to run back that D1 line over and over and over again. And that's like a trickle effect. Like, you're clearly showing in that moment, we don't trust this other group of players to be out there on the field. And the players can sense that. And not only can they sense like the lack of confidence, but also frustration starts to mount in that moment too. And you start to lose focus. They switched up their whole game plan. Like, they put Joe White over on the O-line. Not that that's necessarily a bad decision as a general thing to do, but like, you haven't really done that all season, and now you're just going to change your whole strategy, like, in this one game, doesn't really make a lot of sense. You're right. I think you're right. It's like not a measurable thing. It's not necessarily something that we have an analytic for, but like, you can sometimes just tell like who's confident, who's not out there. And well, you got to go out there with confidence.
I want to give like a lot of credit to the fact of when you're playing New York and that pressure starts to come on and you start to feel like, oh no, we're slipping behind. And there's been this just like, again, one of the things that's also like not happened is teams even holding a slight 1-2 goal edge at the end of these games. It's always New York kind of holding out serve and getting to leverage their style at the end of these games where it comes down to big plays, star moments, mm-hmm. tight defense. Like that is what the foundation of this New York reign has been built on. And it's just that no other team can elevate to that. No other team has those components to be able to force their leverage in the same spots. And it just, it's frustrating to talk about. It's frustrating to not have more of an in as far as, well, if you get to New York's handlers, you might be able to affect some pressure on their back. No, that doesn't happen. Like, those things don't happen. The things that happen to every other team that you can sort of talk about as X's and O's and a response and then a reaction, that doesn't happen for New York. They seem to play by their own set of rules. Again, it's just, it's stupid. It's dumb luck. That's what it comes down to sometimes. For as talented as they are, this reign, this 30-game win streak, is constructed on a lot of dumb luck too.
This is the perfect segue actually into the next thing that we wanted to talk about, which is who do we think might be the MVP this year? And it's a perfect segue because New York has been MVP central for, well, seemingly for, it feels like forever at this point.
Four straight years. Ben Yacht in 2019 and 2021, Ryan Osgar mm-hmm. in 2022, and Jeff Babbitt in 2023. So, there's been three perfect seasons in there. So it kind of, you know, stands to reason that the crown goes on the head of the representative of one of those teams. But mm-hmm. I hear you. It's been sort of a tiring stretch of MVP candidates all but in
I think
neon
it speaks
green
to,
and black.
It speaks to the, like, dumb luck, right? Is like, is it dumb luck or is it, hey, like, we have three MVP winners on our team. And, you know, at the end of a game in crunch time, those are the types of players you want, right? So,
well, and they probably have another 2-3 who would deserve it on their own rights. I mean, you talk about Jack Williams, last year's defensive player of the year, Antoine Davis, who I think you could have made an argument for being the team's MVP and therefore maybe the league MVP, especially given how he shut down top offensive players in the second half of last season. This team is constructed stupid top heavy that it is hard to get away from sort of the gravitational pull of so many freaking stars.
If I asked you right now, MVP, who wins the MVP, and I gave you New York, someone from New York or the field, someone from any other team, what do you think?
I mean, I would be stupid to not take a player from New York at this point. Particularly when Jack Williams doesn't have an MVP to his name, and that just feels asinine almost. I mean, the other part is that I do feel like something's got to give. I know I kind of said that last year, but I feel like the field does have a shot. There is something about the pressure that builds up when there is such a singular opponent that everyone has to take on that I feel like New York will take some beatings, just taking opponents best shot after best shot after best shot. But like,
if New York loses a game this year, do you just give the MVP to whoever played best in that game against them? Is that like, we're just like, oh, there it is. Like,
the problem is exactly what you talked about a moment ago, though, which is that the team that beats New York will probably have a pretty terrific team effort. I mean, yeah. You look back at the box scores of the 2021 championship game for Carolina and that Atlanta win as well, and those were complete team games. It's mm-hmm. impossible to pick out sort of a primary performer from either of those lineups. But I don't know. What are your two non-New York MVP candidates for this year? Because I'm sure we'll be talking a ton about the top end of New York. I want to get some space for some other players who are very deserving in this league.
Sure. And I think it kind of goes without saying, like, to be an MVP candidate, you have to at minimum be on a playoff team, but even more so probably being on the top team or at least second best team in your division. You have to be on a team where you're really, you have championship weekend aspirations and it seems like believable that you're going to be there. Right. So That automatically eliminates a lot of like who we might talk about, some great individuals on teams that maybe aren't quite ready for that leap. But I mean, I'm going to take the lowest hanging fruit here, right? The guy who has been in the conversation the last 2 years, and I would argue in 2022 had a season that would have made him the MVP of any other year other than that one. And that's Jordan Kerr. Jordan Kerr has put up stupid numbers in the last two seasons with Salt Lake. It looks like you just, it looks like when you create yourself on a video game and you just turn everything up as high as it will let you. And, you know, you just break every record and, you know, nobody can cover you. That's kind of what Jordan Kerr has looked like the last two seasons. He is, while Salt Lake has many great players, like he is head and shoulders above everyone else out there when it comes to just how much of an effect he has on the game. I mean, it seems like it's gotten to the point where if he isn't at or at least nearing double digit scores in a game, you almost wonder what happened. Yeah. Did he sit out too many points? Like, oh, was he having a little hammy issue and they just decided to rest him? Like, how come Jordan Kerr didn't have 13 scores this week? He's tall. He's as fast as anyone else on the field. He's got those throws that he just, that inside backhand, anytime he gets near the goal line, it just kind of seems like a foregone conclusion that the assist is coming. He is the engine that makes that offense run. He's so much fun to watch too, and he does it in a variety of ways, and he's just as likely to beat you deep with his speed as he is to beat you deep with a throw. I mean, he is one of the most dangerous players on any ultimate field anywhere. I mean, how can you argue against that?
Also, clutch. I think one of the things that gets lost in some of the numbers are the performances that he puts up in big games. Now, he was obviously held to a very suboptimal performance in last year's championship game. He threw just one assist, but he only had one turnover. He was 24-25 on the day, and it was a drop. It wasn't even his fault. Still finished with over 350 yards total on the game. And before that, in the prior two playoff games, 7 assists, 33-34, over 450 total yards against Minnesota in the semifinals. 8 assists, 3 goals, 27-27, over 500 total yards in the West Division Championship game. In 2022, in the West Division Championship game, 7 assists, 1 goal, 40-41 from the field, 635 yards of total offense against Colorado in an elimination game. And in his first ever playoff game last year, or in 2022, excuse me, against San Diego, 5 assists, 1 goal, 19-21, 400 total yards of offense. I mean, this is one of the best playoff performers we've ever seen. He has 28 assists in 5 career postseason games. He doesn't slow down when the tough gets going. He only gets better, it seems like. And what was scary last year was that he got better after what you said was maybe one of the greatest statistical seasons ever in 2022. He was better in 2023. Do you think he gets better in 2024?
He's trending that way. I mean, yeah, if you look at the assist numbers, like they're way down from the year before, but you have to take into account how much better that offense was across the board, adding Grant Linsley, adding Elijah Jaime. They just kind of were able to spread the wealth a little bit more, and he didn't have to, you know, throw 78 assists, which is an insane number. The other thing is, like, upped his completion percentage, you know, turnovers. He had 9 less turnovers, almost cut his turnovers in half, or his throwaways in half last year. Like,
he's a sniper from deep, too. He's completing 82% of his hucks on the career.
Yeah.
Just and remarkable.
I mean, you kind of, he's played 3 years, like he played in, you know, San Jose in 2021, and you just see like the numbers just keep getting better. And even block numbers, I mean, he had 8 blocks last year, more than double what he had in 2022. So like he improved in getting the disc back for his team too. It just, it seems like we're still scratching the surface with him. Like it does feel like he's just going to continue to get better year in, year out. I know he's one of those guys that works tirelessly in the offseason too. Like he is grinding to improve all the time. So this isn't just happening by accident. I mean, he is putting in the work to do this. I think he's just the most obvious candidate. Let's go ahead and move on, though, because, like, we could talk about Jordan Kerr for forever. So let's move on. And I'm actually my second guy that I'm going with that staying in the same division. I kind of thought about this for a while because I was toying around with one of his teammates also maybe being on the list, but I'm going to go with Quinn Feiner. And I did have some consideration for Alex Atkins. I will say Alex Atkins has not been able to, you know, in his two seasons, he hasn't been able to stay healthy the whole season. Obviously, being on the field and being able to contribute more is a big thing. I hope we can see an Alex Atkins that is able to be healthy all year this year. So, because he could be in this mix. But Quinn Feiner has been healthy in the 2 years he's played. He feels like the guy out in Colorado. When I saw their lineup initially in 2022, you know, I, of course, was immediately drawn to Nethercutt and Jay Fruit and Matt Jackson. And, you know, Quinn Feiner, who I had heard of but hadn't been on a field, you know, a semi-pro field yet. Like, he hadn't been on UFA field. I didn't know what to expect from him. He just came out of the gates and just started producing, like, basically from day one. And the thing that he did last year that was so impressive to me is he increased his completions by almost 100 last year. So he's getting way more involved in the offense. It seems like it really kind of runs through him. I wouldn't say quite to the degree of what we saw with like Jordan Kerr in 2022, where it just felt like everything went through him, but it does feel like they are most successful when Feiner can get his hands on the disc one or two times every possession. He's great in the deep space, both as a thrower and a receiver. He is pretty good at defense. His block numbers, I think, don't quite, for me at least, match up with like how good of a defender I think he is, but he does have the ability to get the disc back when he does get it. Like, didn't he get like the layout block on Jack Williams last year? Was that him?
Benyat.
On Benyat, that's right.
Oh, he was hunting on Benyat in that matchup.
Yes. And that was like, that just kind of shows his playmaking ability too.
Yeah.
So he is somebody, he's another guy like Jordan Kerr that I think is just going to continue to get better this year. He's a pretty young guy. Like, he's got, he's another guy I know that is training year round tirelessly to continue to improve. So I'm excited to see how he does this year, especially with the absence of Cody Spicer we talked about. I think the offense is going to have to take a step up in efficiency. And I think it's going to start with Quinn Feiner, you know, just continuing to improve in his role.
Yeah. I mean, when we talk about efficiency offense, I think of two players in this league. I think number one, Ryan Osgar, the 2022 MVP. He's sort of on another planet with the raw production totals plus the sort of completion percentage, huck percentage, efficiency numbers that he can come up with. Right below him is Quinn Feiner. I mean, you look at his completion percentage, the way he can connect on these long balls at such a high clip. He's almost at 80% career in his first two seasons on huck attempt completions. He's got 153 scores in 27 career games. These are NASA grade numbers, and it's all in this quick twitch, no hesitation, knows he's the trigger puller kind of role that I think, just, you know, when you look around at the landscape and kind of start thinking who could possibly be MVP, Feiner simply rises above most because there is not his combination of environment, skills, and I think to your point about playmaking, confidence in his abilities like Feiner. Like, he exudes professionalism, I think. There hasn't been a moment that he's played in this league where he looked overwhelmed whatsoever, mm-hmm. right? Like, he just gets the disc on an under, turns up field and is able to go through his reads in a split second to choose who he wants to pull that trigger to on a forehand hook downfield. And I totally agree with you. I think Feiner's got to be up there. Atkins, if he can stay healthy for a full season. As far as my non-New York players, I think there's a couple of directions I wanted to go with this. Obviously, you could choose somebody from DC, New York's kind of rival. I think, to your point about teams that could beat New York, Atlanta, if they get a win against them and have somebody like an Austin Taylor or Brett Halsmeier have a big performance in that game, I think they could. I think I'm going to start with somebody who's been really great in this league for a really long time, and I think has always been an amazing performer, but kind of comes and goes in as far as his rotational element in the team. But if they have another big year this year, I think he could really elevate into an MVP finalist. I'm talking about Jacob Fairfax, man. That dude can do it all. And I just feel like the Flyers had kind of a down year last year. They got bounced out in the first round of the playoffs for the first time since 2016. This is usually a team that wins 10-plus regular season games. They look like they're going to have, I think, a resurgent and more bought-in rotation this year. And I feel like that's just going to benefit Fairfax. I mean, he was already second-team All-UFA last year in kind of an tumultuous Flyers 2023 campaign. If they get more stability, if he gets to not just have to sort of plug in wherever, and he can just go out and put up another 30 assist, 40 goal year as he's prone to doing, I really think we could start talking about him being one of the best players in the UFA. I mean, you talk about other stats besides just the raw counting numbers on offense. I mean, maybe the best O-line defensive cover player in the league. I mean, he is just next level with his ability to generate blocks if the offense makes a mistake. You know, he has, I think, double-digit blocks in most of his career seasons. He's led the team numerous times as an offensive starter in takeaways. So he's second. He is second in their franchise's history in blocks behind David Richardson, albeit he's like half as many as D. Rich. But to the point of how good of a cover player he is, should the Flyers offense turn it, Fairfax is way up there. I just think he's got it. And I think he's, again, kind of in a finer position where he gets to tween a little bit. If they use him sometimes more in a handler facilitator role, he gets to improve some of those volume metrics. I mean, just go to the tape. Anyone who's followed this league for any number of years knows who Jacob Fairfax is. I mean, he simply rises above the pack to make some of the most hellacious sky plays every single season. He had a terrific performance at 2021 championship weekend that kind of got overclouded by the fact that everyone on the Flyers had a terrific weekend back in that September. But yeah, Fairfax is my first choice, I think, for just kind of a non-New York player. And then I'm going to go to the South Division again. You're double dipping in the West. I'm double dipping in the South. We're going to go to Austin, last year's championship weekend representative from the division. And I'm going to split it. I know you didn't do it with the Colorado players. I have to do it with Kyle Henke and Evan Swiatek. They're just too good and too versatile in each of their roles. It feels like they each give similar things, but in their own unique ways. I think Henke has become so excellent in his ability to sort of become more efficient as he stepped into a larger and larger facilitating role. And then Swiatek, I think, is similar to Fairfax in that his overall game just gets understated all of the time. He's just a workhorse, no matter where you put him. If you want him in the handler set, he's going to run his defender ragged. If you put him downfield, he's one of the best route runners and has some of the best stamina in the league. And then, similar to Fairfax, if there are turnovers, he is a beast in cover off of in the counter. So
just to ask the Atlanta Hustle.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to get basically a block per game. I think the world of him. He makes highlights. He's a team leader. You go ask anybody on the Soul who their favorite player is, you'll get a lot of responses of Evan Swiatek. And then, you know, flip side of that again, back to Henke. He's been one of the league stars for several seasons. He continues to have bigger and bigger performances in playoff games, albeit last year in the semifinals, Antoine Davis sort of shut him down. I think he's going to respond to that this year. Henke, Swiatek, Jacob Fairfax, those are going to be kind of my dark horse picks, non-New York MVP candidates going into 2024.
I can't argue. Swiatek, since he's come to the league, has been fantastic. Henke has been great for a long time, getting better. There's one thing that would hold Henke back. It would be the throwaway numbers.
Not that bad.
Well, I mean, last year, you know, completion percentage hovering under 91%, maybe not quite where, maybe that could have won the MVP in, you know, 2017. But I feel like in today's UFA, you got to be a little bit more efficient. But Swiatek, I mean, that dude, you talk about, you know, we talked about Ambrose earlier and how many plays he makes. I feel like Swiatek and Hanky both are guys who just show up on highlight reels constantly because they're also making just crazy plays all the time. When we talk about Jacob Fairfax, Jacob Fairfax is like the top guy. Like on my list of players I wish I could play with, Jacob Fairfax is top of the list. Like for my money, he might be the best athlete in the entire league. When you just look at the things he can do from a speed and agility perspective, from a leaping perspective, and given like how big of a body he is too, it's just like he seems like he's kind of the whole package. And like you said, if he was on a D-line, he would, I think, lead the league in blocks. Like
he might.
He has that kind of ability. So like he seems like, as we've talked about Jack Williams in the past, about how he kind of seems like he can do it all. And it's like, does he really specialize in anything? I kind of feel like Fairfax is almost like that on steroids, like because of the defensive ability that he has that I think is kind of unmatched. But we'll see. We named five players. New York has five players on their roster alone that could probably win it. So we'll see what ends up happening. But it'll be something we keep an eye on. I'm sure all of these players, while they can't all win the MVP, obviously, I'm sure all of these players will be in the conversation deep into the season. It'll be interesting to see, you know, how that shakes out as we get closer to playoff time and where these teams even stand. Because, you know, mentioned Fairfax, you know, that's a team that didn't even really sniff championship weekend last year. And I think if Fairfax, for instance, is going to have a chance, the Carolina team as a whole needs to be better. But I think they're going to be better this year. I know you touched on it. You think they're going to be a little more consistent, a little better this year. So might have a chance.
I would be remiss if I also didn't jam in like three more names. Khalif El-Salam on Seattle, if they make the playoffs in like a West Division championship game even, like he could absolutely fill that void. I mean, he only played in seven games last year, but was already putting up MVP-like numbers for the Cascades. Thomas Edmonds for DC. I can't believe you left off your boy. You had your opportunity to run the flag up the pole for the Thomas Edmonds fan club.
I just don't know what they're going to do with
him. Totally missed out on it. Okay. You don't trust Lauren Boyle? You don't trust the new head coach? That's what I'm hearing. Cameron Brock doesn't trust new DC's head coach to play Thomas Edmonds well. I think if Edmonds gets like full rotation and possibly picks up some reps, and we'll discuss this next week as we talk about rosters. DC is going to be missing some pretty notable players in 2024. Edmonds could pick up some of those opportunities. And boy, he knows how to take opportunities well. And then I had one more. What was the last one? Oh, it's going to fry my brain. That was the two main ones. Sean McDougal. You mentioned McDougal yeah. earlier. I Pavel Giannis obviously made a meteoric impact on that team, but you go back and you watch the tape. I mean, McDougal, the amount of times he had like one man bookends where he would pick a pass off and then just complete the point like a throw or two later on his own. Tremendous. Mm-hmm. I just don't know many people who can have the kind of scoring and overall effect on a game like McDougal. But let's move on. We'll have tons of time to discuss the MVP, particularly as we actually get into the season and have some real numbers to work around with and don't just have to prognosticate. I hate the preseason. I'll just admit that right now. I hate this preview stuff. I hate not knowing. I like analysis so much more. It's so hard to know what these guys are going to do weeks before we even get a chance to look at them for the first time in several months. So that's my little bone to pick. I could do a whole episode on it. We need to move on. My next question for you, Cam. Last year, we saw a lot of divisional upheaval. There were three first-time championship weekend attendees in Austin, Minnesota, and Salt Lake. Obviously, New York, the lone veteran and pedigreed winner, came away with the championship. But in 2024, do you think we're going to see a similar sort of divisional chaos? I mean, we have already kind of talked about how the West is just ready to explode. It feels like everyone's just sitting on a powder keg out there, but you look around the rest of this league, I mean, the South is by no means settled. Last year, it felt like any one of those three teams could walk away with the divisional title, and it feels that way again in 2024. The East obviously has been the domain of New York for several seasons, but to your points about Philly and DC and maybe even Boston if they kind of continue to move forward with some of this rotational consistency and inertia after making their first playoff appearance last year as a franchise. They could have some opportunity to maybe move into the truly elite of the East Division. And then in the Central, I mean, I think Minnesota has to enter as the favorites to repeat as divisional champs, but you guys in Indy have something to say about that. Chicago is adding a bunch of really interesting players this offseason. They could retake the throne that they occupied in 2021 and 2022. Is this another year where we don't kind of know what to expect at the top of each of these divisions?
Yeah, so here's what I'd say. I don't expect there to be a new team to championship weekend. I think everyone who makes it this year will be a team who's been there before. I feel pretty confident saying that. But as far as teams from last year going back this year, the only team I would say I feel any like above 50% confidence about would be New York.
Not even Salt Lake?
No, not even Salt Lake. And the reason is because I expect Colorado to actually be better this year. I know they lost Cody Spicer, but I just expect with kind of the fallout of last year and some roster consistency issues, and they had some injury issues. We saw in that game against New York, they looked pretty good. Like, we kind of saw where they could have been had maybe things shaken out the way we expected. So I don't think Salt Lake is head and shoulders above Colorado. Like, I think Colorado has as good of a chance to win that division as Salt Lake does. And I don't want to discount anyone who might finish in third in that division as not being in it. I do think there is a clear gap between Colorado, Salt Lake, and whoever finishes in third. But I don't
LA
think
it's
so much of a gap.
Right now.
I don't
LA
think it's so much of a gap that it can't be overcome. Like, it's not – we're not talking, like, that they don't have a chance. It's just I would be kind of surprised. But then again, you know, we saw what happened last year when LA went in and just kind of knocked Colorado in the teeth a little bit. I think in the Central, you're right. Like, you probably have Minnesota as the favorite. I do think the loss of Abe Coffin can't be understated, though. Like, that is such a big loss for them. He's just a guy with so much experience playing in big games. He's a calming force too, I think, on that line.
He was huge in that semifinal game.
He was.
He was great for them as kind of the he didn't have a whole bunch of big moments, but he had a great huck at one point to Quinn Snyder and had, I think, one turnover with damn near 40 touches.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I can speak to us, like, in Indy. Like, we feel pretty good about our roster. We aren't returning everyone from last year, but we did have some, I think, key additions, and I think we have some really good young players. I think we're faster than we've ever been, more athletic than we've ever been. We do have a lot of newer players to the league, so can we use that speed and athleticism in a way that's, you know, positive and generates some positive momentum for us? I mean, I think so. We'll see what happens when games start. And in the South, like you said, like, we expect Carolina to probably be better than last year. Any of those three teams feel like they could come out of that division. So it kind of feels like when you have three teams where you can't really figure it out, the odds favor that one of, you know, you have two teams that didn't make it last year and one did. So I would say probably a new team makes it from the South this year. So if I had to put like a number on it, I would say at most, I think two teams head back to championship weekend this year that were there last year. What two of those are? New York plus one. You know, which is the plus one? I don't know, but I think it's New York plus one, and that's where I'll land on that.
Yeah. Just to kind of bring it into context, I think, a little bit, particularly in the South, strength of schedule. Carolina has the second toughest schedule in the league. Atlanta has the fourth toughest schedule. Austin has the easiest schedule in the entire UFA. Last year, it felt like that might be Austin's undoing, but they somehow, after losing all of their regular season games to Carolina and Atlanta, reversed that in their playoff road to the semifinals against New York. Maybe the Soul can do a similar sort of activation in the postseason as they did last year, but that feels very risky. It doesn't really feel like a strategy you can implement year over year. In the Central, you guys have the second easiest schedule in the entire league. Minnesota has one of the five easy schedules. So it figures that both of you should kind of be able to take advantage of that. In the West, Colorado has the third toughest schedule in the entire league. They're featured heavily on the Super Series and Game of the Week slate. They'll be facing off against Minnesota and you guys in Indy. They have a bunch of interdivisional games. They're going to definitely get their test, but they feel like a team that could really benefit from that. On the inverse of that, Oakland and Seattle, both the third easiest and the fourth easiest schedules in the entire league this year. So they could be big beneficiaries, whereas Los Angeles, a little bit tougher of a schedule. San Diego, very tough schedule. Portland, very tough schedule. Obviously, because last year those teams finished at the bottom of the division, so they're going to, of course, have the schedule and winning percentages inverted against them. Anyways, just wanted to kind of give a little bit of that context as far as what to maybe expect from some of these teams. But
Oh, I was going to say something that's kind of interesting, though. You look at those percentages. We've seen Chicago with some pickups. And another one that was announced recently was Jacob Reuben Miller. That's not a name a lot of people outside of the Central might know. But in his first season in Madison in 2022, right, he was – maybe the biggest playmaker on their defense, and that's including KPS, not just from a generating blocks, but from being the person who was finishing off the breaks. He had great games against us, and I saw him wreaking havoc for other teams too. Missed the end of that season due to injury, was out all last year. He was somebody I was thinking about coming back to Madison and kind of reigniting that defense with maybe the KPS coming back as well. And instead, he's going over to Chicago, where they've already picked up Jeff Weiss. You know, they've picked up a couple of other players. They've announced some key returners. So, and Minnesota and Chicago play three times this year. That could be the big decider. I mean, Minnesota, I think, definitely is capable of winning the division in the regular season. And, you know, having the road go through Seafoam Stadium, which no one in our division wants. We all hate playing in Seafoam Stadium. It just feels, even though Chicago has had some success up there, it's not a place you enjoy going to play at. But with those three games being against each other and us only playing Minnesota one time, they might take each other out of the way for us. And we might just be the beneficiaries of the schedule, which happens some years. So obviously it would go a long way for us if we can beat them in our head-to-head matchup. But you know, we'll see what happens. I'm excited to see what those matchups look like, because going into the schedule, when I saw it, knowing how Chicago's roster and Minnesota's roster were last year, it looked like, well, probably not going to be that big of an impact, but seeing the additions that Chicago's, put on their roster, I think makes those games a lot more interesting now. So we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago already had a really solid defense last year. I think they're going to have a pretty solid unit again this year. It looks like they might lose Jace Brunner, who led the team last year in blocks. But they had a really solid system and have generally played a sort of Central Division style that slows opposing offenses down, really tries to make it into a possession-based game. So we'll see if Chicago can obviously take advantage of some of their new signings. But wanted to move into our last segment of this episode, the last sort of point of, I should say, this segment about 2024 narratives. And that is, how will the new polling rules of last season carry over into the second season of existence in 2024? You know, last year we saw such a pronounced effect on and diminishing of offense in this league. I mean, I was going through and compounding some of the overall team stats from 2022 to 2023. There was a nearly 6 percentage point dip in offensive efficiency, a near 7.5% dip in hold percentage from 2022 to 2023, 3.6% dip in team completion rating, a 2.6% increase in team break percentage, meaning teams were obviously getting into the end zone more on defense. And maybe most perplexingly, defensive efficiency only up a single percentage, which seems almost statistically insignificant to me. Obviously, I'm not a huge math nerd or anything. Somebody will probably correct me in a message soon. But there seemed to be more of a deleterious effect on the offense than themselves than necessarily an improvement of defense's ability to cash in on those opportunities, right? There seemed to be this almost mucking up of offensive play with the way in which possessions had to start back so much further. There was so much more attrition to get drives going. Do you anticipate that going into 2024 to continue? Do you think that there will continue to be this downward trend in offensive production and more of a sturdiness and I think reliance on defense? Defense as being the meta, I think is how we like to kind of talk about it.
First off, shout out Indy Alley Cats D-line players who for the last 2 years have been phenomenal at converting breaks, because they're definitely not contributing to that lower percentage there. So shout out to my...
Oh, no, it still did improve a percentage. I'm just saying relative to the 7.4% dip in hold from 2022 to 2023 on offense.
Sure.
The 1 percentage point or 2.6% break percentage increase is like negligible to me, right?
No,
like it
100%.
Feels like it should be closer to like 5.
100%. But I got to shout out the homies. All right. So the polling rules. So I've been going back and forth on this. On one hand, I'm like, teams are going to start employing more of these line drive, hard to catch pulls. Like we saw certain teams did this better than others. Probably no team did it better than Minnesota with Berglund and Lacey, like just rocketing these discs at impossible to catch angles and never, you know, We actually talked about this at our practices over the weekend about how hard it was to field those pulls and like how you really have to go into the game with like a strategy for what you're going to do. You can't just kind of figure it out on the run there. So I go back and forth. Our team's going to get better at fielding them and thus better at getting their offense started faster, which you think would, you know, kind of maybe have those numbers regress back to where they were before? Or are more teams going to be... find ways to create those situations that Minnesota was so good at, where you have these pulling specialists who, you know, it used to just be get the disc a lot of hang time and try to let your defense set up by the time they catch it. Now it's, can we put them in so deep in their end zone and fielding such an uncomfortable disc that they have no chance to get started and they're starting deeper. So I kind of go back and forth. It's really going to depend on how teams decide to, I think, can they find a Sam Berglund? Can they find a Cameron Lacey that can consistently do these pulls? I also kind of wonder if the new disc will aid in this. One thing that the new disc we're playing with this year does is it holds its edge pretty much through the entire flight path, where the old disc wrap discs we use, especially in a windy condition, they might start at one angle and then go into a sharper angle as the disc flies. I kind of wonder if that's going to have any effect on these poles being more consistent, because when you know it's going to hold the angle, you can kind of more pinpoint where you want to throw it and with what angle you want to throw it at. So I'll be really curious to see which gives. Do teams get better at fielding the poles, or do the polling teams get better at making the polls hard to field? I expect it probably to stay pretty similar this year, since we're still just in year two, and I don't know if teams are really going to fully adjust that quickly. But over time, it'll be interesting to see if those numbers kind of go back to where they used to be, or if they just kind of continue to favor the defense. And last year, the biggest predictor of who was going to make championship weekend was defense, where it's always been offense in the past. So I actually expect that to be pretty similar this year. I would be very shocked if we don't see something similar where all the teams who make championship weekend are the top defensive team in their division, or at least very close in, you know, ranking to whoever is top in their division.
We didn't have it like as a particular part of this show, but you talking about that, I wonder, are we going to start considering pullers as more of a central category in defensive player of the year conversations? Because I'm just kind of looking, you obviously mentioned Sam Berglund and the effect that he had on Minnesota's defense last year, but I look at like Paul Owens, he tied Berglund for the most amount of pulls in the league last year. You think about Philly's successes last year, a lot of it had to do with their defensive efficiency, their ability to get pressure on opposing offenses. Owens had 16 blocks, again, tied the league with the most pulls. You know who was third in most pulls last year? Ben Yacht. You know, he had 17 blocks. Like, how can we start to, I think, as coverage people and analysts and players and coaches, integrate more into our storytelling what these pulls mean and how they actually impact? You know, one of the stats that I've been thinking of wanting this last offseason, average starting position on offense. Where is the offense taking over? I feel like if you were to look at Minnesota's defense, they're just pinning people to within yards of their own goal line, whereas maybe another team is conceding those first 20, 25 yards. Mm-hmm. That makes a huge difference. You know, just kind of an aside, I think people really underestimate the yardage, like what 10 yards means on a field. It changes your complete perspective as a thrower or player wherever you are in a field. And so, like, those little metrics matter. Like, 10 yard penalties, they matter in terms of field setup and positioning. Like, getting the end zone or fielding the pull, I should say, and getting 10 yards of clearance before a defender comes into your space and starts affecting your possession, that's a big deal. And so I'd love to see, like, where these teams are actually taking over. Anyways, I'm once again off on a massive or into a massive rabbit hole.
I think there's a point here, though, because, like, one thing I think people don't think about when they think about ultimate is how much space you have to work with behind you. Like, we're always focused on the space upfield, right? But, like, if you're starting with a defender on you, say, 10 yards from the back of your end zone, like, normally you're like, at least in our offense, and I think in any good offense, you can be okay with losing some yards, resetting the disc behind you, just to reset the stall count and get things moving. But when you're starting within 10 yards of being out of bounds, you do one dump pass and you kind of feel like you don't have the option to do it again. And it just tightens up the space so much. The other thing is, like you said, like, how much time are you getting with the disc before defenders in your face? Offenses are so much hard to guard. And this is every sport that involves movement whatsoever. You think of basketball, you think of soccer. Offense is so much harder to guard when things are in motion. Right. Like, when you look at, like, the Golden State Warriors have been, like, the best example of this probably in recent memory, when you've looked at the teams that, you know, we're going to the finals every year. When you watch them play, everyone was in motion constantly and the ball was moving quickly. And when you look at those Spurs teams that were so good, when the ball was just kind of ping-ponging back and forth, like, those teams are hard to guard because, just like an ultimate, when the disc is moving as a defender, you're constantly having to, I know we call it here in Indy, orbiting. I don't know the term everyone uses, but basically what it means is, as a defender, you're constantly having to reorient yourself to where the disc is and where you need to be effective as a defender on the person you're guarding. When the disc is in motion, that's much harder. When the disc kind of stops and stays in a similar spot, you can kind of, you know, that's when you can start baiting those decisions. And that's when you can kind of really zero in on where a throw might be going. But when you're starting deep in your territory with defense on you and you're not able to just get the motion started, that's when you see teams get in trouble. And I think that's why we saw all the offensive struggles last year with the pole line being moved up and teams figuring out how to pin that disc deep. It just made for a lot of uncomfortable situations.
So you've left me the opportunity to segue into, speaking of uncomfortable, do you want to describe your current haircut? We've made it now an hour into this podcast. I've got nothing else to talk about as far as the 2024 narratives, but we've just let our viewers, if you're only listening to this episode, Cam has a new road strip mohawk he's sporting on this episode. I know you do it yearly as a part of your teaching. Why don't you explain what you've got going on up top?
Sure. I'm not uncomfortable at all with this.
I would be cold with that, man. I've got way too much hair. This
it is does, the inverse. When I first shave it off, it does feel cold. I will say that. So I teach middle school. I have taught middle school now for 7 years. This actually started 8 years ago when I was still teaching high school. I was having a lot of trouble, imagine this, getting kids to turn homework in.
And in high school?
Yeah.
Homework.
Having trouble. So I decided, you know what, let me set up a reward system for these kids that might get them turning their homework in. So essentially as a class challenge, if everyone in the class turns their homework in, they get a check mark and they have to do it for 5 consecutive days. And at 5 days, they all got like some small reward. And if they made it to everyone turning their homework 10 days in a row, you know, it was this. Well, the Mohawk was a 20-day homework streak for everyone in the class. So we're talking 25 kids all turning their homework in 20 times in a row. It created the most positive peer pressure I've ever seen in my life. I'd see kids before school. Hey, did you do your homework? Come on, go get your homework done. Wait, you don't have Mr. Brock till after lunch, right? Like, go get your homework done during lunch today. Like, it was hilarious. Kids were like on each other about doing their homework, which is like every teacher's dream. Like, oh yeah, they're all on each other about this. Well, then I just kind of carried it with me to the middle school, and I didn't quite have the same, you know, expectation for what they needed to do. I just kind of started doing it every year. I would dye at school colors. It was just some way, a fun way to get kids engaged and kind of show some school spirit. And so you can't see it with the lighting I have now because it's not very bright in here, but this is actually dark green. It's like an emerald, I think is what it said, but it's like a dark green color because that's what the kids voted on. They voted on color, and
it's Alley Cat's color. Come on, Cam.
It worked out for me. It's a little darker, I think, than our green, although...
All right.
But you know, it's something fun I do with the kids every year, and they get a kick out of it. And the funny thing is, at first, they're always like, oh, Mr. Brock, why did you do this? And then by the end of the first day, they're like, actually, I kind of like it. And so it starts off as like exactly how you would imagine a bunch of seventh graders with no filters are. They're like, Mr. Brock, why'd you do that to your hair? Like, oh, did you lose a bet? Like, what's going on? And I'm just like, nah, I just like it. It's fun. And then by the time they're at the end of the day, they're like, yeah, actually, it's pretty cool. Like, they can't believe their teacher is willing to do this to themselves. So here I am. Green Mohawk, just having fun with my seventh graders, you know. I'm sure that we had people wondering the whole time, like, what is wrong with Cam? Like, they probably thought I lost a bet.
He just had a lobotomy before this episode. It's not a big thing. No, it's good to know you're susceptible to peer pressure, because maybe I can bait you into something later this season, some kind of other hair gig or another promotional thing. I don't know if you can do hair with mine. I never quite got around to making that bet with Daniel as to whether we would cut our hair over some kind of bet.
Maybe we could see Babyface Ruffner, maybe shave off the
beard. Nobody wants that. It's like seeing a turtle out of its shell. Like, it's like when dad shaves for the first time. Everyone would just be like disconcerted and maybe start crying. But we'll see. The season's long. That'll do it for this episode. I know we didn't necessarily end on Ultimate Frisbee, but we'll pick it up next week when we come back. Obviously, Lucas Ambrose signing with Seattle, all of the big storylines heading into 2024. And then, of course, next week, we get rosters. And from there, it really feels like the full tilt into preseason. And then, of course, opening poll, April 26th, just 6 weeks away now. Really looking forward to that. That'll do it for us here and now, though. We'll talk to you soon. Bye now.